And next, I'm very pleased to welcome Linda Slakey, who will be joining us and sharing results from the...
Thank you. You're going to hear a lot of themes echoed. I'm sure there are some kind of common problems and common findings when you begin to think seriously about how to do these things. So I want to give you just a little bit of context for what this report is about, and then a very brief summary of some of its contents. I apologize, the full report is not up on the web right now. It should go up momentarily. It turns out this meeting caught it between a draft that was up for a while and the copy editing that was going to put the full glossy PDF version back up on the web. So I will make sure the meeting organizers get that URL and get sent out to the participants. So the context for this task group report is when Cora Merritt, who is...
Just a little bit.
Okay, let's not... So, okay. When Cora Merritt became the AD for Education and Human Resources, she gave the directorate some themes to work by, one of which was what she called cyber-enabled learning. She was very aware that we needed to be paying attention to this in a broader way than we had been. Amongst the programs in the Directorate for Education and Human Resources, there were a number of individual things that have been funded, many individual projects, learning projects, and some whole programs like the National STEM Digital Library. But she felt a need for some guidance and advice that would give a sense of direction as we were going forward. And she worked with Dan Atkins, at that time the director of the Office of Cyber Infrastructure, and they jointly asked their advisory committees to give them advice. There's a specialty involved here. When the NSF formally asks for advice, then one of the advisory committees has to do that. So what happened then was that the advisory committees jointly from Education and Human Resources and the Office of Cyber Infrastructure invited and charged a task group to give us a broad sense of direction. And the task force was asked to address what the opportunities were, what the research questions should be, what the partners would be that we would work with, to frame their recommendations in terms of broad strategies, and also to take a look at our existing resources and use of them. And it was asked to do so within the universe of the disciplines that the NSF funds, but they pointed out to us, of course, that the things that they found would also be relevant to the humanities. But the answers and recommendations that they gave us are framed in terms of the subject areas that the NSF funds. The task force members are given on the next slide, and I want to just take a moment here to say a little bit about the timeline they were asked to work on. Often when the NSF has asked for formal reports of this kind, the task group will have as much as 2 years to work on it, and they'll hold hearings and gather evidence. This task group was what Dan Atkins calls hit and run. It was intentionally convened and asked to give us a full report within a few months. And so an effort was made to accumulate representative expertise, and they were told basically operate on the expertise of the members. You don't have time, although, of course, each of them is aware of the field in a broad way. You don't have time to hold public hearings and that kind of evidence gathering. So this group of people, all of whom have busy lives, did an amazing job of putting together a very substantive report on what for this kind of work is actually very short notice. So they first thing they did was alter their charge. We had asked them to comment on cyber-enabled learning, and they said, no, that's not a good name. You should call it cyber learning by analogy with cyber infrastructure. And then they provided a definition, what was going to be their working definition of cyber learning, which is the use of networked computing and emphasis on the networked as opposed to single tools, and communications technologies to support learning. And then the full report gives a lot of information, both documentation of earlier reports and their own thinking about the utility of cyber learning that I'm sure I don't need to give this group. So I actually pulled some of the slides. This slide deck is one that they prepared. So I pulled some of the slides that give the underlying philosophy on the presupposition that I could take that as read in this group. I did, however, include their comment on why cyber learning was timely. This is a classic NSF question. When we're going to invest in something, then we have to tell the director and the director has to tell Congress, why is it important to invest in this now? Why is it timely for the NSF? And the answer to that in the task group's view is that, first of all, it builds on a great deal of work that the NSF has already done. It's a moment of powerful new technologies, as a previous speaker called attention to. It's also an interesting moment in growth of understanding of how people learn. There are segments of the NSF and then other research fields more broadly that have produced a great deal in the last two decades of understanding in ever-increasing detail how people learn, so that that can all be brought to bear, that you aren't just designing tools from either the computer point of view or even the domain learning point of view, but with everything really deeply informed by contemporary understandings of how people learn. And so that then can give rise to a whole generation that wouldn't have been possible even a short time ago. And then finally, that feeds into a very intense current sense of demand that we be coming up with solutions to pressing educational problems. I would actually add an element to this, and it is, in fact, part of their earlier philosophical statement. If we don't do this, the children are going to leave the schools behind, because the next generation is used to using these tools all the time. And if we don't, in fact, incorporate them into education, the children will be increasingly disaffected. I think of this as most seriously a problem in the early ages of school, where the children are apt to be very savvy, and if the school context is not keeping up, that disconnect is going to widen. So that seems to me an important element of one of the demands for solutions, so to speak.
Can I make a quick comment, too? Yeah. Also, there's a lot of interest in robust decision-making. Unfortunately, a lot of the research that I've seen, it's onesie-twosies type of learning and not entire learning systems. We have to understand the decision-making process that happens across in a distributed sense, because it's very meaningful.
Yes. That again, echoes a theme that came up over and over again in their thinking, too. They framed their report because they were asked specifically to give two units at the NSF advice about how it should frame its programming and its thinking going forward. They framed their response in terms of strategies and then opportunities for action, which they saw as things we could actually implement in a sense of funded programming, and they looked in terms of both short-term payoff and long-term promise. If you look at the full report, you'll find that there's a long list of strategies and a longer list of actions. For purposes of presentation, they distill them down into a set of themes, and what I'm going to do is just touch briefly on the themes and then equally briefly echo them in terms of their specific recommendations of things that the NSF particularly really ought to consider doing and doing sooner rather than later. So the themes then, developing advancing technologies, enabling students to use data, and so forth. We'll take a look at each of these just briefly. So under promoting new talent and new technologies, they're interested in coordinating learning across contexts. They think in terms of attracting new people into the education sector who might not have seen that as what they were doing before, and also framing the way we provide support in such a way as to be constantly breaking the envelope in terms of the use of the technologies. In terms of looking now at the actual interface of any tools that we might develop or support with the students, they want to draw the students into new ways of looking at content and prepare them for computational thinking, again, echoing something that Jeanette focused on earlier. And so in the report, in the sidebars, they give a number of examples of contemporary projects that they think are exemplars. For example, the Galaxy Zoo project. And another sort of key element of using cyber tools in learning is the incredible basis it gives for them subsequent looking back and reflecting on the learning that was going on. So the teacher develops or uses a tool, and then the students use that tool, and the teacher's focus is on the student's learning, but in the meantime, the tool is collecting data on effectiveness of the learning. So then the researcher can come along and look at the collected data and say, what have we learned about learning here? And the little inserts across the bottom are just an example of that. of data collected, and the vertical axis is the percent of error rate as concepts in geometry were taught by a smart tutor, and then the horizontal axis is just number of repetitions. So you can see that if you're learning the area of a circle or the area of a trapezoid, you start out with a high error rate, and with repeated iterations, the error rate goes down. And if you're doing area of a square or a rectangle, the error rate's very low to begin with. So it jumps out of these data at you that you don't spend very much instructional time on the things that people already know. You can focus your attention, and the tools, by the way, once they get smart enough, can focus the student's attention. Why they did 10 iterations of the area of a square after the student got it right on the first one, you have to wonder. But maybe it was for the purpose of testing the tool per se, yes.
Are they addressing privacy in this?
Is there what?
Are they addressing privacy in this? I mean,
yeah, all these things have to address privacy. That is one of the concerns. I'm skating over a bunch of big issues here, but maintaining student privacy in this is cumulative data with a number of participants. Yeah. Although the tools are designed to recognize the individual student and respond to the individual student's needs. But there are privacy issues in terms of then using the data for later understanding.
Well, it's an interesting way to weight it, because security and privacy actually have a lot of parallels. So as you figure out how to do that, the military can figure out how to do the same sort of problems.
Yeah, right. And then another one of their key themes is to, when you're working on something, consider the number of audiences that it can eventually attract. This is particularly one of my own pet themes, that as we work within I'm the director of the Division for Undergraduate Education, and one of the key elements that we're trying to see move forward in undergraduate education is to have the students have authentic discovery experiences, sort of at the opposite extreme from canned labs. Not only labs that are based on inquiry, but labs in which the students are actually working with new data and finding new answers, not things that are already known. And so platforms that are designed for researchers to use, but that also easily draw in people with less expertise or earlier stages in the learning, are very powerful. And also, of course, can keep people engaged for a lifetime. So then turning to an issue that, again, was alluded to by the earlier speaker and is absolutely critical one for our work, and that is this whole really complicated and vexing question of how you sustain things. I'm not going to talk about their examples here because this one comes up actually in more detail later. It is, in my opinion, one of the absolute key challenges that we face, that we don't spin our wheels, spend our time developing stuff, and then it fades before it can be used, or fades just when it's beginning to be most effective. So then, having gone through a consideration of these themes in the early part of the report, they turn then to more explicit recommendations, which echo the themes. So one is that they're urging us, in terms of things, again, that the NSF could actually act on, to build what they call a vibrant cyber learning field. And by analogy, they remind us that the NSF has had a critical role in turning nanotechnology into a field that's approached from a number of directions by key sort of center-level support and paying attention within the NSF to issues across the directorate boundaries. And so they invite us to do the same kind of thing with respect to cyber learning. And then the second, of course, very much echoing what Henry told you, and the fourth and fifth, I think, echoing what he told you as well. The third is more an emphasis from within education. So what could the NSF actually do to build a field? It's in a position because of the fact that it is funding people across the whole spectrum to really promote by the funding tools that it uses, funding that draws in all the relevant fields, not only the technology, but the people who are on top of the material on how students learn, the domain scientists and the social scientists. I'm here to share with you the report that was given to us. Every now and then I find myself lapsing into an editorial comment of my own, so let me just bracket. This is an editorial comment of my own. I'm not sure that the NSF has a lot of influence on publishing best practices, but we do have an influence on recruiting the various fellowship areas that the NSF has supported for years, and that it expands now as an opportunity to explicitly participate in recruiting talent. They emphasize over and over again throughout the report that we really have to instill a platform perspective. That is, this sort of tools that of which there are one or two examples, are a great waste of everybody's time. At the NSF, again, because of the funding mechanism, is in a position to emphasize that it wants to entertain proposals that contribute toward this agenda. And it, again, they give some examples and some detail of what they mean. The NSF has two, and specifically the Division of Education and Human Resources. The NSF has a lot of things going on, but within Education and Human Resources, which recall invited this report in the first place, there are two what you might view as platforms, the NSDL, which is a repository of electronic objects for learning, and a whole set of strategies for making those more visible and more available to teachers and learners, and then also a program designed to draw young students and their teachers into feeling comfortable with and being effective with instructional technologies. And so the task force sort of charged, so to speak, the next level to do a very explicit review of how those programs were going, specifically with respect to their potential in their next stages to bring about implementation of some of the task force recommendations. Under the heading of encouraging us to emphasize the transformative power of the technology, beyond sort of reinforcing some philosophical issues, the potential for learning, and also the technical issues that the technology allows. In this section of the report, they call attention to the need for teachers' professional development. I would have made that a whole, again, an editorial comment as I sort of step aside here, snaky editorial comment. I would have made that a whole big chapter of the report myself. I think it cannot be stressed too much that we can't leave the teachers behind. Some of the sort of grand plans for software really must take into account that the American school system is not going to go away anytime soon. It is, in fact, the United States mechanism for child care from 9 o'clock to 3 in the afternoon, among other things. So in spite of the cyber potential for a learner to be interacting directly with a whole wider world, if that doesn't happen in the context of school, with the people in charge of those classrooms feeling comfortable and confident, then that's a very big gap opening up. So I think it's incumbent on us to include in our thinking so that it keeps pace with the technical advance and the social advances, what we're doing to make sure that schools and teachers, schools as in school districts and their policies, and teachers as in their comfort and confidence in the classroom, come along with what's happening technically. Promoting open resources, a sort of variant of platform. Things should be on a platform that's widely interoperable, and they should be available. That's also a place where the NSF can have an influence by simply insisting that work that we support conform to that standard. And then finally we come to the vexing issue of how to sustain projects. And that really is a vexing issue. The NSF is in the business by its mission, this gets reiterated in the laws that reauthorize us, of funding the cutting edge. And we take that very seriously. You know, every solicitation says, what's new about this project? On the other hand, for these new things that we're funding to be useful, there has to be provision for how they're going to be sustainable. And so we are very open at this stage to conversations about what constitute appropriate models of sustainability. Whose business is it, after all, to pay for the sort of ongoing availability of newly developed materials and platforms? The simple publishing model in which it's commercially viable to sell textbooks is under attack, as well the publishers know. And besides, we're talking about things that are much more widely networked. Nonetheless, those projects have to stay sustainable, and so do the efforts that I referred to earlier of drawing in the schools and the teachers. So that's a very interesting challenge, one that we think about, one that I certainly don't have any answers for. We wrote it into the most recent solicitation for NSDL that every project had to say certain explicit things about its sustainability plan, and we meant specific business plans, particularly for projects that were coming in for their second round of funding, had to be competitive, had to have a business plan for how the materials were going to stay available going forward. So I'll just end with the acknowledgments that the task force provided at the end of their report. This was supported by the National Science Foundation with leadership from Dan Atkins and Diana Roten in Office of Cyber Infrastructure, and Cora Merritt, Barbara Olds, and Jim Colby in the Directorate for Education and Human Resources. And then they acknowledged as well various support that they had from some of their own staff. Thank you.